Welcome back to Vulcan Hello, the Incomparables only podcast dedicated to new Star Trek. I'm Scott McNulty, joined, as always, by Mr. Jason Snell. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Scott. It's good. Nobody has created yet a competing incomparable podcast also about new Star Trek, so we remain exclusive to the network.
You never know. There's a lot of new Star Trek, and this is, what, like the first time in 23 years or something where two new episodes of Star Trek debuted on the same day.
On the same day.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
I haven't watched that episode of Prodigy yet, so I can't talk about it.
Oh, I did watch that episode of Prodigy. Prodigy? Prodigy.
The other Prodigy. One. Prodigy.
There you go. The animated one. For the kids.
But not that animated one.
No, the other animated one.
Not that old one.
Animated one. There is, it just occurred to me right now, there's much animated Star Trek. Who knew? But we're not here to talk about animated Star Trek,
no.
Jason. We're here to talk about
live action
Star Trek. Specifically, Star Trek Discovery Season 4, Episode 1, Kobayashi Maru. And if you didn't know what that meant, they explain in the episode.
Yes, so. For all those who didn't see many episodes of Star Trek and many movies of Star Trek.
And I'm sure there are some people who are firing up Discovery for the first time and starting on the fourth season premiere and saying, you know,
I don't
know what this is all about.
About this Kobayashi Maru, what's that all about?
Yeah, it's a no-win situation that many Starfleet captains do not believe in.
I think, well, this is one of the questions I have for you is, in this episode, we meet our new Federation president.
Yes, Bajoran Cardassian lady.
She's apparently Bajoran Cardassian human, so she's she is many. She's a melting pot of Federation races.
And a real politician.
Apparently, and also a real backseat driver. And it's literally like, well, the president wants to watch you be the captain of the Discovery. Sorry, there's nothing I can do. I'm only the commander-in-chief of Starfleet. Okay, well, listen, Admiral. First off, you can stand up to her. You've chosen not to. And then she's just like, I'm just going to watch and question everything you do. And that's really dumb. And it was annoying. And I thought that this is not making me like her or think that the Federation is actually a good organization. Although I guess over Star Trek history, we know that lots of Federation does lots of stupid stuff.
Yes.
But here's my question, which is president of the Federation, who claims to know all about the Kobayashi Maru, but of course they haven't actually had Starfleet Academy in 100 years. Yeah, so how would she, other than through legend,
and Burnham about that
has to explain it to her, says something about what the Kobayashi Maru is for, which is it is there to train you to avoid the Pyrrhic victory, right? Avoid the thing that gets you killed when you could have made smarter decisions and sacrificed, you know, having the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. I think here's my problem with that. I don't think that's what the Kobayashi Maru is about at all. It's about captains learning to deal with death, right? According to my Star Trek 2, anyway, it's about captains being willing to make hard decisions that might lead in their death, but they are the right decisions to make, which seems to me. So throughout this episode, I'm like, I think Burnham really understands the Kobayashi Maru way better than the random president who's trying to collar on it. And yet I'm not entirely sure that the show isn't saying, ha-ha, Burnham must learn an important lesson here. Because I doubt that the story arc for the season is going to be, ha-ha, Federation president lady must learn an important... Like, that's not what it's going to be. But anyway, I don't... I guess we can all differ, but like it's not what Kobayashi Maru means to me. I don't read it as let Tilly die because you don't want to take a risk. Like, I just don't think, maybe I'm in the Captain Kirk school here, but like,
well, that is old school Captain Kirk thinking.
It's like 1,000-year old school now.
Very old school at the moment, yes. Well, I think that there are, what they are trying to do, I think, is juxtaposition the two schools of leadership, right? The Burnham, like, you know, we're a crew, I'm not leave no person behind, with the politician who they make so very clear, even before the lady has done anything, that Michael Burnham just doesn't like her.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I think they could have just let us watch as the Federation president became annoying, and then Burnham had a reason not to like her instead of immediately not liking her. But anyway,
totally, 100%.
Her kind of school of thought is, well, you know, you have to look at, you know, it's complicated. Not everybody's going to win. You need to take as much as you can. And I kind of, you know, given the situation that the Federation has found itself
in. True, which she says. This is a time of rebuilding. We cannot afford people who are taking big swings because it could be a wrecking ball. And that is fair.
And that is not, that I think is a very valid viewpoint for the president of the Federation. I think it is probably a less valid viewpoint for the captain of your, basically your flagship vessel in your, you know, exploratory squadron. And so Michael Burnham, they just, their worldviews are not incompatible, but they don't join together.
I guess I don't need them to agree. And having her interpret the Kobayashi Maru that way, I think is a fine thing for that character to do, even though I don't agree with it. And I guess what's tugging on me a little bit here is that I'm not sure this show agrees with Burnham. I think maybe the show is sort of making it out that Burnham is going to be misguided here and she's going to have to learn a hard lesson, whereas I think Burnham is completely right. But so that maybe I need to learn a hard lesson too. But I think you make a very good point, which is they could show the Federation president doing these things, and instead there's a lot of sort of telling of, she's a politician, I don't like her, and I can't believe you came on the ship to do this. And it's just, it seems weird and awkward, and they make her, if we're supposed to take her seriously, why is she micromanaging from the back of the bridge? It's like, I don't like that decision at all, that she's there second-guessing everything Burnham does as the president of the Federation, not even the head of Starfleet Command, but the president of the Federation, and saying, well, you know, I was considering you for this list of ship captains for our experimental ship is not much of an excuse.
No, and you would think, so she is set up, like we just meet this character in this episode, right? But it's fairly early, clearly established that we should think of her as kind of a seasoned politician who knows what she's doing and has a mission and kind of, you know, has become the president of the Federation. One assumes, they don't really go through the electoral process. I don't know how she became the president. She's new. She's, you know, trying to figure her way out in her job here. But you would imagine that she would be like, I am not the president of anything, but I know that, you know, if you're going to second guess a captain, you kind of, you know, take them aside and say, hey, maybe you should rethink this, instead of just on the bridge, just, you know, basically not yelling, but they're having a conversation in front of everybody that is an inappropriate conversation at inappropriate times too. Like, this space station is hurtling into big Lord knows where.
Ice blocks are flying at them and their shields are up. Yeah. And
the president is like, hey, are you sure you should be doing that?
Yeah.
And Burnham's like, are you telling me not to? And she's like, no.
That really bugged me about this is that I would be okay if she was an observer. I would be okay if she just sort of challenged Burnham and then at the end of the episode they came back and she's like, all right, we need to talk. Or if it was all sort of filtered through the admiral, who again is sort of like, just like, not my problem, it's your problem.
Good luck.
But the way she does it is really dumb. it just really bugged me that she's just going to stand there and second guess everything that Burnham does during a. And you're like, well, no, but you're the captain. I was like, well, yeah, but you're standing here talking to me while I'm trying to do my job. And maybe that was part of the test. I don't know. I did have a moment when Tilly was trapped over there. Tilly and Adira were trapped on the repair ship with the various repair people, including the dumb guy who was in charge, who I thought was a Packlid for a while. And then I realized he wasn't quite that dumb, but he big head and was kind of dumb.
I think he's just under a lot of pressure.
But I had that moment where I thought, wait a second, is this a Kobayashi Maru test? Is it going to be Burnham, you really showed us what a Kobayashi Maru test is, and all the students, all 18 cadets in Starfleet Academy will learn from your example. But no, that doesn't actually happen.
It's an actual thing.
It's real.
It's happening.
Yeah.
And I will say, so this the commander of this space station makes some questionable decisions under...
Yes, Nahlis. Poor old Nahlis.
And I will say a shout out to that actor. He is also on Kim's Convenience, which is a fine Canadian sitcom. Mm-hmm. And he plays a very funny character on that show. So just watch Kim's Convenience. It's a wonderful show. But anyway, but I was thinking to myself, he doesn't seem like the greatest Starfleet officer. But then I don't think this is actually purposeful. But then I was thinking, well, Starfleet Academy hasn't existed for 100 years. Yeah. So none of these people have really, like, these are not... These are people who are doing a job that they really haven't been trained for, right? So I don't know why they're doing these jobs, but they are.
I mean, it does call into question, I guess we should talk about Starfleet Academy being back in business. It does call into question what Starfleet Academy is for, because I assume you can enlist in Starfleet and not go through the academy.
I guess that's true.
Theoretically, you would then be like O'Brien. You would be a not commissioned, and you would just be in the ranks. And so he was a chief petty officer, basically chief warrant officer, whatever his title was. And you know, you don't get the track that you do if you go through a service academy. That's kind of the model here. But you're right. I think you could maybe also argue that the way the Federation worked when it was falling apart was sort of like planets sent people and said, put these people in your Starfleet. And it was just much more ragtag, whereas they're trying to get all their act together. I guess that's one of the issues that I have with the Federation president standing on the bridge, too, was like, I don't know, I kind of wanted more of a sense from this episode about how the Federation is putting itself back together. And having the Federation president just decide to go out with Discovery didn't seem like I was getting, like, do you have enough time to do that? Like, you're putting all this other stuff together? I don't know. Yeah. It was, I mean, and they said she's got this ulterior motive, which is they're working on sort of experimental ships with a next generation spore drive and a pathway drive, which I kept thinking, clearly these things are going to be important later.
No, I'm sure we'll never hear of them again.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's the same thing, which is just sort of like, I don't think... I know it's a lot to deal with, but we had a 1,000-year time jump. You got the Federation trying to put itself back together. I think that there's maybe more that needs to be dealt with there than this episode actually deals with.
I think that is very true. And I do, I don't, well, I mean, I think it's weird that the president wants to be on Discovery. So I'm assuming that that is going to be. Like, I think that there's more there than her reasoning, which is, I want to see, you know, I was putting you through your paces, Burnham. And you can kind of understand one thing she says is, you know, well, you have this spore drive and it's going to be critically important to the Federation. So I kind of want to see how it works, which I understand.
I wonder, and I wish they would deal with this because I think that it would actually help the show a lot if they did, is for them to say, we lost it. After the burn, and even before the burn, we were kind of not that great. And you, 20 people or 10 people or however many people came over from Discovery, you are a shot in the arm to us because you are from the wild frontier days of the Federation. You connect us and you have a history with the Federation as it was, and that's super, like, valuable to us. Like, that's what I keep... kind of wanting to hear, because you know there are only a few people who came across from the past on Discovery, and I'm actually, other than because it's a TV show, I'm a little surprised they're keeping them all together and that they haven't sort of spread them out. We do get the sense that some of them do go off and help other ships, because while they are behind the times, they're also kind of like these representatives of this time that was lost, and so they're kind of inspirational. And I don't think the show has really dealt with that much, other than funny lines. And the line was funny, right? It's like, not everybody has space-time shenanigans. It's like, well, yeah.
That is funny.
It's true. It's a good point.
I also enjoyed... when they're on the butterfly people planet, and Burnham said, why does there always have to be a cliff?
Yeah, that I wrote that down. Why is there always a cliff? Yeah, the opening, fun cold open, that reminded me of Star Trek Into Darkness and Star Trek Beyond, both, where it's like, why don't we start with a exciting mission that goes a little bit awry on a planet somewhere? And so we have the kind of casual zombie butterfly people.
They're very casual. It hadn't really crossed my mind, but they're just casual in their forest, just hanging out.
They're like, well, I mean, at one point, the emperor of the butterfly people responds to Burnham as like, oh, sure. He's like all sarcastic, no strings attached, whatevs. And I'm like, okay, butterfly people.
Of course they're laid back.
But they, but you know, I enjoyed that scene because it's like, we're the Federation, we're nice. And they're like, what do you mean no strings attached? We don't believe it. And they're like, no, we mean it. And then, of course, there's an incident because of Grudge.
Grudge.
And they fix their satellites. And they're like, see, now you can fly right, butterfly. Yeah,
and now we're leaving. And I did like that because it does, so I think that, and I don't know why they're doing it this way, but they're brushing against this theme of, you know, the Federation repairing itself and the Federation, you know, not having the reputation that it once did.
Right.
And because they clearly did something to these butterfly people and the butterfly people do not trust them.
Right.
And so Burnham is there to say, we're here to help. We don't want anything from you. Here's some dilithium. Adios. And by the way, we fix your satellites.
Oh, I actually also really liked when the Emperor says something like, you know, even before the burn, our relations with you were sour, and now you expect to tell me that the Federation's all better now. I really want to burn and be like, look, I wasn't around for that.
Don't blame me.
I'm from 1,000 years ago, and so all I can tell you is that whatever happened before, we're under new management now.
Okay? That's right. We're in a rebuilding phase, and we could really
we don't know about those guys. That was 100 years ago. I was traveling through time then. Just let bygones be bygones.
It's complicated.
Let's pick
your
it
butterfly
up from
people.
Here.
You understand how things can be complicated.
Yeah, it's a challenging thing, and I know that they've got other stories that they want to tell. But I do think that the fascinating thing to me about this scenario is that you've got a Federation that's trying to put itself back together and figure out how to connect a whole bunch of planets that have sort of fallen apart or have gone missing. And you know, we end up with in this episode seeing what the story arc for the season is going to be, which is this gravitational anomaly that's destroying things that they have to figure out. And like every year, it feels like there is some big idea that is happening, a big thing that they have to figure out. And that's okay. It feels a little samey, the red signals and, you know, whatever. And the whole thing with the burn. But I think what bothers me the most is putting the Federation back together strikes me as being enough of a thing to hang a season on. And they're like, no, gravitational anomaly. I'm like, all right, okay, I guess we'll do that. But like, I feel like you could go from planet to planet trying to figure this stuff out with the butterfly people and all the other people who are out there like that. And that would be an interesting, and dealing with the politics and dealing with exploration and all those things. But the show doesn't want to do that.
Well, I think there are a couple things, right? The show wants to have exciting set pieces, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, blowing up a planet is exciting.
It's very exciting.
Knocking it out of its orb. I guess it's kind of blown up.
Yeah.
Well, spoilers. Yeah, it's not planet.
Quajon
doesn't survive.
Yes. Bad news for everybody who loved that empty living room from last season.
It is a really nice living room.
Can I
but not
say,
anymore.
But Quajon, just as an aside here.
How does that place work?
They go there for the tree bar mitzvah. And it's literally book his friend and his friend's kid. And I get that.
I was expecting a bigger crowd.
I get that it's COVID and all that, but like you could do cutaways, you could do whatever. That literally it's them alone in the woods. And already last season we had the whole thing where it's like this planet is empty. They say that there's lots of people on this planet. We never see any of them. And here again, the bar mitzvah, it's literally just those three people out in the woods. And they have the chutzpah, I guess. It's a bar mitzvah. Why not? To say, go run and play with all of your friends now to the kid. It's like, where are the friends? Like, there are no friends. Where are they? Are they outside the forest? Does he have to go on a hike to find his friends and say, we did it
in the next planet? Over.
And so when Quajon is destroyed by the gravitational anomaly, and Book is very sad, which I understand. I just had this moment where I thought
all his stuff is there.
Did the whole living room, the big screen TV, it's gone. I think Discovery's writers really think that we're invested more in Quajon than we are because it really was just that bad episode that didn't show anybody. And it was like just empty rooms. And then now we have an empty forest with the two. I mean, I'm sad for the little kid and his dad who are Book's friends, but presumably his off screen friends too, who they all died and it was horrible. But like, I don't know. It's just of all the planets to kill, I'm like, Quajon.
What ever. I did write when the little kid goes off to run off to his off-screen friends.
Yes.
Hundreds of off-screen friends.
Go to
friends.
Your invisible friends, yeah.
I wrote in my notes, something bad is going to happen to that kid.
Yeah.
And I was totally right. Well, I didn't expect the whole planet to be destroyed.
No.
I agree with you, but I don't think the writers think we care too much about the planet, but they think that we care about Book, and so he's sad,
and
we're sad for him.
I feel like they seem to just be going through the motions, and these appearances with Quajon, it's like, well, we got to get people to care about Book, so I guess we got to, and it's like, I just don't care about his trees.
We don't really need his planet, but I'm assuming, and we don't have his planet, no. So it's fine.
Thank goodness it was not essential.
Well, and so in that scene, we also find out that, you know, all those people wear little necklaces with sap from this tree, but Book doesn't wear his, so there's something there, right? So we're going to learn a bit about his connection to his planet.
Yeah, and is he going to be able to plant a tree somewhere? And
yeah, one assumes that he'll have to plant the spirit tree or whatever they called it somewhere else if he can.
Yeah. I mean, it is, from character-wise, I mean, it does give you that shock at the end of the episode, nothing like destroying a planet to make everybody sit forward and say, oh boy, this is serious. And it's a good character thing for Book, who is an interesting character, and David Ayala is a fun actor. I really like him. He's so charismatic. He's really fun. I'm glad that he's still on the show.
Yes.
And this gives him a lot of things to play with because he's, you know, the captain's boyfriend and sort of on the crew, but kind of not because he's got his wild, wacky little, you know,
little
transformer ship. And now he's obviously got this burden of his being the last of the Time Lords and last of the Tree Lords.
Tree Lords. He's a Tree Lord, Jason.
Yeah.
Get it right.
So what's that going to... I mean, that's all good. Like, that character is really interesting, and now he's got this burden to bear, and I think that's going to be very interesting. I just had to laugh at how badly I think they handle the depiction of that planet where there's nobody on it.
No.
And
he has great... continues to have great chemistry with Sonequa Martin-Green. So whenever they're on screen together, I totally believe that they are, you know, in a relationship and they're having fun, and I'm having fun watching them.
Oh, that opening scene where they're like staring daggers at each other, and he's like trying to make little jokes to the zombie butterfly people,
and she's like, no,
cut it out. Stop. And then she turns the table and is like, do your empathy thing, and he's like, these people, no,
they're not interested.
It's not going to happen. Yeah, no, that's all good. I what I really want, Scott, is I really wanted that line where he says they're all gone. I wanted him to say all 800 of them. I'd be like, what? There's only 800 people on that planet? Oh, that explains a lot.
Eco-warriors. They don't want to overburden.
No, it's just a very small... They had a camp, and they had one living room, and that was about it.
That's all they need. They're simple people.
Yes.
With spiritual trees. I mean, it's ridiculous, but...
It's okay. Can we talk? Let's talk about Saru has a couple of scenes where Saru and Sakaal and the Grand Council of Kaminar, who are in an aquarium,
because they've patched it up with their enslavers, and now they're working together.
Yeah,
which is nice. You know, it's been several hundred years, so you know, that's good. And the Saru's people seem to, you know, they're no longer enslaved, which is great, and they're having a discussion about should we stay, and you know, we're going to get our dilithium. Should we focus on our planet because this is really, you know, we should, you know, charity starts at home,
sure.
Or should we go off in the universe and check things out? And they're having this discussion, and then someone says, blessed elder or something.
How about the great venerated elder?
Yes, and I thought that was very funny because, you know, Saru is
1,000 years old.
Very old, yes. So, and of course, you know, if you're listening, this is your first time listening to this podcast, you may be surprised, and especially if this is the first time you've watched Discovery, but Saru is one of our favorite characters.
Indeed.
So it's always nice to see him, and he says some lovely things about basically, we don't want to be inward looking, let's go out.
He's got a keynote presentation that he'd like to give about the importance of looking outward and not just inward that he gives.
He has some little audio-visual tools that help, and he reminds everyone.
It's like, but we're in a galaxy, and outside the galaxy there's nothing. So I guess you could say we're all on a planet together, and that planet is the galaxy. Thank you for listening to my TED Talk, my Kaminar Talk.
That's right.
yes.
Tip your waitstaff.
Ted talk.
But, you know, and for people who haven't seen the last season, right, Saru is there because they save Sokal, who, you know, started the whole burn. It doesn't really matter. But he needs to reintegrate with society, and Saru has promised him that he will be there for him. And basically, Sokal is like, you know, I value your friendship, but I have other friends now. Yeah. I have people who care about me. You can go. You're not happy.
That was a non-essential scene. Like,
it was.
First off, like, again, Sokal, I don't really need to see Sokal again. I'm glad that there are a couple moments in here where I feel like it's very much the producers going, the fans need to know. The fans need closure on Sokal. So we're going to have a scene where Sokal says, it's fine, Saru. I know you want to go back to Discovery. You should go. I'll be fine. And he's like, God, that's great. And everybody's like, great. It was so good that they said goodbye. And I'm sitting there thinking, I didn't need to see Sokal again. It's fine. I get, like, suffice to say, they took him home. He's fine. Great.
I like Sokal.
And the other, you know, it's a weird performance, but it's good. And I really liked that storyline last year. So that's all good. I wanted to mention the other one that is, there's that scene that is just there for the fans, which is we see the Admiral walking with his wife and daughter. Mm-hmm. And it's like literally because there was that weird scene last year where Burnham was like, oh, I didn't know you had a child. And he said, oh, yes, my wife and child are we had to send them away for safety, but they'll return one day. And I thought, that's really weird. Like, are they really coming back or did they die or what's going on? And in this episode, they're like, no, they're back. It's great. It's fine. And I think Burnham says, like, it's good to see your family's back. And he goes, yeah, it is great, isn't it? Like, okay. Again, not really necessary, but I appreciate thank you for the follow-up. Thank you.
We had questions about this guy's family. I actually completely forgot that he had a family. So it was, I did think it was funny that he was like, oh, I can't stop the president because I have to go have dinner with my family. Yeah. So you sort it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's why they sent him away, send the family away, is that he's much less effective admiral when.
Very distracting.
Yeah. Anyway, yes. It's good. It's very much the. We sent Saru to his home planet in order to get him away so that Burnham could be the captain. And now in this episode, we immediately recall him.
Now he's coming back.
Yeah, which is fine because he's great. And I get why they wanted to make Burnham the captain and they needed to find a way to kind of like explain that. But we got to have Doug Jones back because Saru is great and he's back next week, you know, on the bridge. And fantastic.
Great.
Fantastic. Yeah.
I want Saru back, so I have no problems with it. And it, you know, it made sense with the story they were telling last season.
Yeah, they're hitting the themes about this is all about kind of being a community and convincing all the planets that they need. All of them need that pep talk, right? All of them need the "this is better if we work together," because they've all kind of lost that because of the burn. So that I get it. That's important, and so Saru is almost the model for that.
That's right. We're bringing the team back together. Saru, come back. And help us figure out what's happening with this gravitational anomaly. And I guess the part we kind of skipped over is the whole... Well, we didn't skip over it. We've been talking about lots of bits and pieces. But the set piece between it is the space station that gets knocked out of alignment and is swirling through space.
Deep Space Repair Beta 6. I like that it's Deep Space Repair because that's like... it's the garage for that part of the galaxy. Like, you go there and they fix your stuff. But then they're broken. Oh, the irony.
Oh, no.
The Deep Space Repair is... It's Beta 6, too, also. It's not a final. They're still testing it, obviously. It's Beta 6.
And there are not many people on it, because I looked... When they showed it at first, I was like, oh, my goodness, there must be hundreds of people on it. But much like Book's planet, there are only 10 people on this station, so it's okay.
I enjoyed that set piece because... I like that the gravity's upside down, so they're all walking on the ceiling, and it's all inverted, and things are coming down from the floor. I thought that was just fun. That was a fun idea. It's like, yep, the gravity's busted. It's like, okay, that's cool. It was cool
Weird
looking.
Things happen. And Adira gets to do some things.
Yeah. Yeah. And he and the guy is like, no, I'm in charge here. And Adira is like reminded that other people also know about computers and it's not just her. Or sorry, them. Right. And she's got a new haircut, by the way. And Gray is still visible, but only to her. So sorry, them. Gonna keep doing that. So Gray, although Gray was visible, he was visible in the holodeck with Sokal. But when that ended, they made a vow to bring, Ray Culber made a vow to bring back his visibility and made that to Adira too. So we don't know anything about that. Although Adira is an ensign now.
Yes.
So so I noticed that because they're very Tilly-like. It's like, I guess that's what being an ensign is saying dumb stuff and like over-explaining and then realizing you're talking too much, because Tilly used to do that, and now Adira does it.
No, Adira does it. Yep. It's still as amusing as it was when Tilly did it. So,
yeah, I agree. I like the moment where they say, one of my previous hosts like birds.
Like, yes.
Okay. It's weird. Trill. Okay. Weird. It's weird. All right. It's fine. But that was all exciting, I thought. And yes. Like very Star Trek-y of like, we're trying to do this, we're trying to fix that. And you got to put the quantum matrix here, and you got to have the programmable matter over there. And, oh, we can't get to the shuttle bay, and, you know, and some ice fell on the escape pod.
Which leads one thing after another.
Only one person could remove the ice from the escape pod.
Who could do that, Jason?
At least they hung a lantern on it, right? Where Burnham is like, I know I'm the captain, but also I'm the most qualified to do this because I logged a lot of hours in those things, so I should probably do it. At least they had that conversation, but it's like, shouldn't you? Okay, I know there weren't that many people who came with Discovery. Like, maybe nobody else is qualified to go do that. And to be fair, even though she got hit by an ice block, a methane ice block, like, they've got the, you know, it just, she just gets her space suit and keeps going.
I would have been supremely surprised if in the season 4 opener they kill Michael Burnham.
Yeah, it seems right. Maybe she knew that.
It's a bold move.
Maybe she was just like, they're not going to kill me. Die. So that's my Kobayashi Maru.
Exactly. And I did like when the president, I think this is in the scene, Burnham says, are you questioning me? And the president says, asking a question doesn't mean I'm questioning you. which I'm like, I know what you mean, but it's an interesting... a very political politician way of phrasing things.
I really did enjoy the fact that when they send the pod over, Burnham is like just hanging on to the outside. I thought that was a lot of fun. And then they send the pod back for the characters that who have lines of dialogue. And that leads us to that Kobayashi Maru scene. Moment.
Well, and then the scene where the commander who is having a rough time of it, it does the right thing, sends his crew off into the escape pod and speaks for Tilly and Adira when he says, well, we'll wait for the next go around.
Right.
And you see Tilly being like, well, really? But okay, off they go. And then they talk about, you know, what are you going to do next? And there's this interesting scene where he says something about, you know, I'm going to visit my home world. And
I'm 5 days from retirement.
5 days. Well, he dies, yes. But Tilly says, oh, when was the last time you were there? And he said, oh, it's been a long time. I've been living life on autopilot. And Tilly has a meaningful pause there, which leads me to believe that she's thinking about her career and what she should be doing. So I think that's another thing we'll be visiting.
Yeah,
this season is Tilly's kind of wanting to grow and possibly, you know, because I imagine, obviously, everyone they know and love is dead except for the people on Discovery.
Right.
But they're also at a moment in the Federation's history where there's untold avenues of options for them, right? Because they are most qualified people.
Yeah, and they're building all these new ships, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was sort of saying about how these Discovery people are kind of valuable. So I would be surprised if they didn't all like get pulled, other than that it's a show, that they all get pulled off and like put on other ships with spore drives and who are exploring, the people who actually lived during that phase of the Federation's existence. So yeah, where does Tilly fit in? And also, she doesn't appear to be the first officer. She appears to just be the science officer. Like, she's been promoted and she's a lieutenant, and that's great. But that's also a question, like, what is, because she was very career oriented before. She's like, I'm going to be a captain. Like, what is she thinking now about the meaning of life for her, for Sylvia Tilly?
What assumes that Saru is going to come back and be the first officer? So,
not, he's going to be like the Federation liaison or something like that. Right? He can ask all those questions. He can be the official second guesser.
Oh, that's right.
Of Burnham, maybe. that guy also freaks out at one point and holds a phaser, and the Federation president has to give him a little pep talk where she mentions all of the national parks on his planet.
Yeah, Burnham says, I just need to know, have you really visited his planet, or were you lying to him? And I thought, she didn't she didn't say she was there. She just said it was beautiful.
Yeah.
So,
also very political response. She's like, does it matter?
Does it matter? And honestly, it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. No, that was
she got the job done.
That was good. That guy's freaking out, and he's going to die in a couple of scenes. So let's just calm him down. Give the hand over the phaser. Right. It's okay.
So I thought something bad was going to happen to that little boy. I didn't foresee that dude dying. So I did feel bad once they crashed, I knew, oh, he's dead.
Yeah.
But I felt bad for him.
Yeah.
He was going to go home.
I know. He was just 5 days from retirement. It's just such a shame.
And go see the geyser thing.
Yeah,
and,
I know.
Now he's dead.
They'll sprinkle his ashes on the geyser. It'll be he's dead. It's not fine for him. But I wanted to mention, Archer Space Dock.
Oh, very nice.
With a little Enterprise music playing.
Yes.
There's a speech that the Federation president is giving while we see the Archer Space Dock, at one point she pronounces civilizations as civilizations, mm-hmm. right out of the original series. So
good job.
Good,
and that was,
yeah.
I mean, this is another, like, Michael Burnham was very annoyed that the president was going to speak at this event, which seems very strange to me because Starfleet Academy is opening for the first time in 100 years. She's just been elected the president of the Federation. It would be surprising if she didn't speak at this event.
Yeah, I was thinking more that Burnham was annoyed because Burnham had to also speak at it. But I don't know the deal.
I felt
there.
Like she didn't she say something about like, oh, she's just, you know, she's using this for her own purposes. And I was like, well, yeah, her purpose is trying to rebuild the Federation. So
yeah, no,
I think it's okay.
That's a good point. 18 cadets, not a big class. No. You got to start somewhere.
It's people are still, you know, getting their dilithium and trickling in. So
I wonder, and maybe the show will actually go here, because remember last season they went to Earth and Earth was sort of insular and fighting in the solar system and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if we're going to deal with that at some point, because that would actually be, again, maybe not the story they want to tell, but the story that I'm interested in here is like is like going back to Earth and reestablishing ties and getting Earth back in the Federation and maybe being like, can we have the Starfleet Academy back? And they're like, no, we've turned that into a shopping mall. I'm sorry, you can't have
sorry.
It.
Sorry. It's the real estate prices have really
the Bay Area real estate's very expensive. I'm sorry.
That's
it's
right.
not.
It's not. We can,
or maybe they'll be like, oh, yes. Since we left the Federation, the worst thing that's happened is that we've lost all of the real estate prices on Earth. They went way down.
They've plummeted. It's a market crash.
So we need to make those connections. I don't know. But that's wherever Starfleet Academy is, apparently it's in that, you know, the sad space station
taken almost all the cloaking shields off of, but not
entirely.
All of it. And I thought that was kind of weird. But whatever.
They're working on it. It takes they got to refit the Voyager J. They're busy with that now. There's a lot going on there.
And I want to go back to something that you said, Jason, about the story you're interested in and not, you know, necessarily the story they're going to tell. Because we don't know what story they're going to tell. They set up a whole bunch of things. They could go anyway. All we know is there's a gravitational anomaly.
Yeah.
They're going to investigate that. But I feel like here's my hope for this season. Because even though there are many ridiculous things about this episode, I did overall like it because I like the characters and I enjoyed seeing Michael Burnham.
Sure.
So I say, hooray, Discovery is back.
Agreed.
But what I hope that they are doing, because what I think that the Federation stands for right in the show is that people and aliens joining together to solve problems that are bigger than themselves.
There
right?
you go.
And this problem, this gravitational thing, is a large problem that an entity like the Federation is the only way you can solve it. Right.
So
I'm hoping is what they'll do.
I will sign on with that. That is my hope too, which is the gravitational anomaly that forms the backbone of the story arc of the season is not there to be an amazing mystery that is solved by revealing its deep personal connection to one or more members of the main cast of Star Trek Discovery, like the last mm-hmm. 3 years.
Yes.
But is instead a natural disaster that highlights how the themes of connectedness and thinking about something larger than just your small insular community is important and that the Federation is the representative of that. If that's where they're going here, I will be happy with that because that is what I want. I my reaction to the anomaly was, do we need a big Ooga Booga space thing to drive the plot forward? Or is it not complicated enough that they have all these planets out there, some of whom are populated by weird zombie butterfly people, and we need to get them all together? But you make a great point, which is maybe the whole point here is that the anomaly leads to something more than just handing out a bunch of dilithium samples to make people feel better about the Federation. And instead, it's more like, we have to work together or we're all going to die, which that could be very dramatic. And if that's the case, then I expect a dramatic reappearance late in the season by those zombie butterfly people who have apparently some good technology that they'd like to share with the Federation, or the Federation would like them to share.
That is what I hope will happen. A, because I like those zombie butterfly people. Mm-hmm. But B, that's a theme that I'm interested in. I agree with you. And I don't particularly mind the whole, the economy of characters, right? You if you want to have some huge mystery, it has to be related to
one of the seven people.
So yeah. To make any sense.
It's Stamets's uncle.
But you are 100% right. They've done that several times already. So let's try something else. And hopefully that is what they're doing. I have no idea what they are doing. All I know is what I've seen. So.
I think you may be on the right path, because I did see an interview with Michelle Paradise, one of the showrunners, who said that the idea of the linking, inciting thing in this season is that it's not a plot of some kind, that it is more of a natural phenomenon that needs to be solved. And your theory that it's really there to make everybody else work together and reinforce those themes of community that Saru so kindly laid out in his presentation. If that's the case, that actually fits what Michelle Paradise was saying, that it's they're trying to have the plot driver this season sort of push the theme forward. And that's great, because bottom line, I don't want it to be Burnham's mom or a Kelpian, a surprise Kelpian, or like. Or that the captain is from the mirror universe or whatever, right? Like, I don't want one of those. I want it to be like, I don't want the solution to be like the thing that's revelatory. I want the revelation to be, if this makes sense, I want the revelation to be the revelation of what we can do together.
Yes.
To solve a problem. Not that the problem solving itself is revelatory, because that's way less interesting to me. It's like it's a Gorn in subspace, it turns out. It's like we finally figured it out. It's a Gorn. We got the Gorn out of there, and now everything's fine. Like, great. Let's do that.
Let's just keep track of your Gorn, people. That's what we've learned.
Count the Gorns. That's what you got to do. It's like, I think they're like planets. You got to count the planets. Mm-hmm. You got to count the Gorns. It's like, how many Gorns did you see? Well, five. Well, I counted six. Mm-hmm. Did we
Where's
lose
that
one?
Gorn?
He's in subspace now. It's bad. Uh-oh. Don't let him in there.
Those Gorn are meddlesome.
They are. They got ants in your walls and Gorns in your subspace, and it's bad. It's just, got to leave out a little Gorn trap. On Cestus 3, you put out some honey and hope that the Gorn shows up.
You put a little piece of Captain Kirk's uniform in there. Yeah. And
and a little bit of blood mixed with a tree.
Yes.
Anyway, I agree with you. I thought this was a fun episode. I thought it looked great. This is the, if people haven't seen it, I'm sure it'll be on YouTube, but it's also in the Will Wheaton Ready Room post-show thing that they do, which is also on YouTube. But they did a little featurette about the LED wall, which is what Disney and Lucasfilm call, and ILM call, the volume. Well, they built one like that for Star Trek Discovery in Toronto. And so they have a little demo of it. And it's, if you've seen any of the stuff about The Mandalorian, that's what it is. But you'll see like the big space where they do the Starfleet Academy thing, and the big like aquarium space where Saru gives his presentation. Like, all of that stuff is in this LED volume. So it's a set with these screens that extend the set, so you can do a bunch of different camera moves and stuff. And it's all happening kind of live, instead of having to do it on green screen and then post-produce it. And it's sort of the new way you make TV. And Discovery is the first Star Trek use of this technology. So it's a fun featurette and you should go try to look for it. And then you will watch the rest of the season trying to say, what are the things that haven't watched The Mandalorian. It's great technology, right? Where you build, mm-hmm. 'cause you build the set up to a certain point, and then after that, it's the screen, and done right. You can't tell where the set ends and the screen begins. And apparently, you know, this is the equivalent of what used to be the Planet Hell sets for TOS and TNG, where it's like a, you know, a big orange dome with some plants in front of it. But that's like, right. A modern version of that where you can have planets and you can actually pan the camera and see the mountains in the background and stuff. So it's that featurette, it's the first one in Ready Room this week, is worth checking out, because I think that lens, that technology is one of the reasons why I thought that this season looked so good, is that I felt like they, the director of this episode, who has directed a bunch of episodes for them, he really likes his fancy camera moves. We've talked about them. Mm-hmm. And one of the fun things about being in the LED volume is he can do his fancy camera moves, because the backgrounds just kind of match. And I could tell that, like, it looked really good and still felt dynamic, and I'm looking forward to them doing more stuff like that. But I liked it. I think the president was kind of annoying, and that aspect of it, and the whole Kobayashi Maru thing felt a little bit off to me. And Quajon, again, is an empty planet full of nothing but trees and two kids. Anymore. And now it's nothing, right? So, you know, I have issues, but I do like the characters. I'm so relieved that Burnham is the captain, and they can just tell a Star Trek show where the main character is the captain. Because as interesting as an idea as it was to see the rise of Burnham, it's like, it's kind of a relief that she's just in charge now, right? Like, yes, okay, really now it's Star Trek, anyway. You mean? Okay, good. Yes, so I'm good. And I would say, I felt like they already have gotten the bridge crew their moments where, you know, even though they're not on the opening credit screen, that we are getting more and more time with all of those characters too. And they're being given substantive things to do. And I'm happy to see that too, because it's fun to have, it's Star Trek, right? So the bridge crew should be a well-oiled machine, and we should know who they are. Even if they're not part of the main ensemble, we should really get to know them. And I feel like at this point, you know, we've gotten to know those characters to the point where, like, one of them is off on another ship for a while, and there's dialogue about that. It's like they're worried we're going to be concerned where he is, and they're like, no, he'll be there. It's fine.
And most importantly, we need to believe that they have relationships with one another.
Yeah, because that's Star Trek.
Exactly. And they have a bunch of you know, banter in this episode that, you know, I was happy to see.
I want to put in a vote. I mean, everybody's going to have their opinion, and it's fine, because everybody, all Star Trek fans are secretly uniform fans.
I was going to say, I liked Burnham's little leather.
The leather jacket thing was good, better than Picard's.
Yes.
I am happy that they have embraced, and I wonder if building the costumes for Strange New Worlds made them rethink it, because the costumes at the end of last season are not the costumes that they wear this season, which is really funny. They introduce them and they're like, no, never mind. And they've gone to the more TOS and TNG, really, like, because it's that color scheme. The colors are at the fore. So Burnham's in red, and if you're at the helm, you're in gold, and Tilly's in blue. And, like, I love it, because I think it looks good. I don't think it looks super weird, but it's also very Star Trek. And when everybody was kind of just wearing gray, it was, or blue, because disco especially, it was like everybody was kind of wearing a blue jumpsuit. And I don't know. I like this better. I think this is better.
I do. And it's easy. I need my Star Trek crews to be color-coded, people. And if I can't tell at a glance what your purpose is, I'm dissatisfied. Enterprise, I'm looking at you.
Yeah, exactly. Except, but the Archer space dock, they could have named it after. It's not named after Jonathan Archer. It's named after his beagle. It's Porthos. It's
Porthos space
dock. Archer space dock. That's right. It's dedicated to a dog.
Oh, a very cute dog.
Dogs
a good
are very
boy.
Popular in the 31st century or wherever they are. I don't even know.
I don't know.
Anyway, it's I'm glad it's back. And although I have some issues with this episode, I am reminded of why I like this show. And I like that it is thoroughly modern take on Star Trek, and that while they're doing the, you know, Picard has a flavor of Star Trek, and Strange New Worlds is going to have a flavor of Star Trek, and obviously Prodigy and Lower Decks have their own flavors of Star Trek. This is the big, big modern streaming J.J. Abrams style, like rollicking Star Trek show and
spectacle.
I think you need that show. I think that this is the flagship show for that reason. And and yeah, taking big swings. I don't know what's going on with that gravitational anomaly, but I'm looking forward to. I'm not looking forward to the Federation president hanging around on the bridge. That needs to stop. But other than that, I'm looking forward to the season.
I think she's going to join the crew. She's going to take over navigation.
She's just going to sit in Burnham's ready room and shake her head. Every time Burnham goes in there, like, she's just going to yell at her.
That reminds me, Jason, do we have a confirmed triple crew member on Discovery?
Oh,
is
yes.
What I want to know. That's what we have to end with this discussion.
It seems like the, well, I was reminded of the mouse droids in Star Wars that zip around, which there's that great Robot Chicken episode that suggests that it's actually a conveyance driven by a mouse, which I love. I think that's my headcanon. It's like, yes, mice are on the Death Star and they are driving little golf carts. But yeah, it is strongly implied that the Tribbles are in the crew now. Which, I mean, maybe how sentient are Tribbles? Maybe they're trained Tribbles and they're kind of like robots, or maybe they've got like, I don't know, for all we know, they are now a composite race where they've got a symbiote. Maybe this is the Trill's solution to their symbiote problem, is they just stick them in Tribbles. Tribble, it's close. Tribble.
Close enough.
The Tribble with Tribbles. But yeah, it sure looks, I mean, it's strongly implied that a Tribble is walking around the Discovery.
With purpose as well. I am impressed by how purposefully that Tribble is walking, I was going to say striding, but I don't think a Tribble can stride.
It's like sliding.
Scooting across the
deck. Yeah, whatever it's doing
there.
I know. These are the key questions. It does seem like maybe there's a Tribble who's got it, like Ensign Tribble. It's like Chief Tribble. Not, they didn't go to Starfleet Academy, so it's more like a Chief Tribble or a you know, junior grade Tribble, something like that.
We'll revisit this in Chief Tribble Watch.
Yes.
Don't worry. We'll be.
Yes.
This is your number one source.
Chief
for
Tribble
Discovery.
Watch, Conspiracy Corner, and What Happened to the Living Room on Quajon. Those are our key segments.
These are the things we need to
for
know.
Season four. Yeah.
That's right. That living room is gone, Jason. Sorry.
Oh, man. All that furniture. It was so nice.
Yeah, well.
Well, it's gonna happen, at some point here we should catch up on Prodigy, but now is probably not the time when we're very excited about Discovery. But I have watched the first three episodes of Prodigy. I think it's fun. I want to see more. There are apparently 20 episodes in the first season, although they're going to parcel them out over time, and they renewed it for a second season. So there's going to be, you know, they're going to tell that story in those little kind of 22-minute chunks. But so far, I'd say it looks good and it's fun. And I saw on Twitter somebody described it as a bunch of kids who are in on a terrible Star Wars planet find a Star Trek ship and leave.
Leave.
And I
yes.
thought, that is exactly what that show is.
It is. And they have a hologram who teaches them how to be better people.
Yeah. They're like, look, we got to deprogram the Star Wars out of you and get you into Star Trek.
It's okay.
That's we'll work it out. Yeah.
You're safe here. Yeah. Have some coffee. No, Janeway, don't feed children coffee.
No, they'll be up all night.
That's right.